Hello, I'm Sir Dudley Pigley Havisham Sedgwick Smythe, Peter's imaginary synthesized personal manservant. I wash and iron his unmentionables, and cut the crust off his sandwiches. It's a thrilling life. This is number 0663, the Stuff File Program, with Peter Anthony Holder. And it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File Program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File Program, number 0663. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File Program, Daniel Calla is back to talk about his 13th novel. This one is a psychological thriller called The Darkness in the Light.
One of the protagonists is a psychiatrist, but I would hesitate to call this a medical thriller. It's much more that Scandinavian noir style. And it all sprung because I had the idea for what I think is a killer twist that I have never seen. It's not that complex, but in all the mystery and thriller reading I've done in my years, I've never seen one executed quite this way because it's told in the first person. And so I built an entire story. I had an idea for a killer twist, and I wanted an incredibly remote, beautiful, exotic setting, and I built the story from there.
Lori Lynn is the author of the children's book, I'm a Pig. She's also a longtime educator who is passionate about setting aside time to read to children so that you're raising a reader.
Just relaxing into one book per night should make you feel like you've done enough. When you can pull your child close and have that connectivity with them and that shared intimate conversation in a book, they're going to feel that security and safety and joy of reading. And that's what we need to instill in them, is that true joy and that warmth of a good book. And then the second point is to really find a quality book that you can give them lots of skills in a fun way without them really knowing it.
Science writer Andrew Mazakis, the Night Sky Guy, is back to share more space news, including the asteroid that recently just skipped through Earth's orbit.
It was the size of the Empire State Building. It just barreled through Earth's orbit at about 37,000 kilometers per hour. Now, luckily, it skipped past our planet, that the closest it was about 3 million kilometers away from us. And that's roughly about 8 times the distance between the Earth and the Moon. That sounds like a lot when you're saying over 3 million kilometers, but when you're talking about astronomical distances, that is really just a hair's breadth away from Earth.
And there's lots and lots of Stuff File news and, of course, an idiot of the day. The guest Slater, the person who told you this was show number 0663, was Sir Dudley Pigley Havisham Sedgwick Smythe, my synthesized personal manservant. You know, growing up as a child, both with watching Batman and reading the comics, I always wanted my own Alfred. Thank you very much, Sir Dudley, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File Program, a show that is listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Let's get right to the stuff! With the help of a fine-feathered friend, investigators in Buncombe County, North Carolina, are finally wrapping a cold case from 2020. It was determined that year that Nellie Sullivan, a woman in her 90s, was missing, but her body was never located. Nevertheless, her granddaughter, 46-year-old Angela Wamsley, and Wamsley's 50-year-old boyfriend, Mark Barnes, were arrested in December 2020 on multiple charges, including concealing a death. On April 14th of this year, a couple out walking their pet duck discovered a container after the duck wandered under a trailer where Wamsley and Barnes once lived. Sullivan's remains were inside. Said Sergeant Mark Walker, "If I could give that duck a medal, I would." He said Wamsley and Barnes continue to collect Sullivan's Social Security and retirement benefits and fill her prescriptions after her demise. Okay, admittedly, I'm just a big city kid who knows very little about rural life, but I'm not going to question why the cops didn't look under the trailer 2 years ago to see if a body might be there, even though the cops clearly thought the couple was suspect since they had multiple charges back in 2020. No, what has me all agog is the idea that someone would be walking a pet duck. Well, at least it quacked the case.
Affleck!
Here's a happy story about a happy couple. An Oklahoma City couple's canceled flight on their way to elope in Las Vegas led to their holding their wedding aboard a Southwest Airlines plane. Southwest Airlines said in a Facebook post that Pam Patterson and Jeremy Salda booked a flight to Vegas and decided to travel in their wedding attire to be ready for their wedding chapel appointment at 9 p.m. The couple arrived at Dallas-Fort Worth International Airport to catch their flight, a connecting flight, to Harry Reid International Airport in Vegas. But after multiple delays, they were told their flight was canceled. A fellow passenger named Chris, who was also attempting to travel from Dallas to Las Vegas, overheard them discussing their predicament and revealed that he was an ordained minister and would be willing to personally preside over their wedding in Las Vegas. The trio booked the last three remaining seats on a Southwest flight from Dallas Love Field Airport to Las Vegas and took a ride-sharing car to get from one Dallas airport to the other. While boarding the new flight, the pilot, Captain Gill, noticed Patterson was wearing a wedding gown and asked her about it. Pam explained their story and joked with Captain Gill that they should just get married on the flight. For the second time that week, Pam was surprised to hear the words, "Let's do it!" The crew decorated the passenger area with toilet paper streamers and used snack mix to create a sash for the minister. A flight attendant named Julie stood in as maid of honor, and a professional photographer who happened to be on the same flight took out her camera to document the ceremony. Another passenger passed around an old notebook for the whole cabin to sign with well wishes and their seat numbers, which was given to the bride and groom as a makeshift guest book. The post congratulated the couple on a memorable in-flight wedding neither our employees nor passengers are likely to forget. I even loved Pam's impromptu vows during her wedding.
I can't wait to be your co-pilot through life, and any turbulence, I want to weather it with you.
Their airport ordeal and in-flight wedding is the stuff of great rom-coms, or at the very least, a Hallmark movie. And folks, get your mind out of the gutter. It was a mile-high wedding. The honeymoon took place on the ground, okay? Yeah. Anyway, let's get to our first guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? One of my favorite authors is back on the show. Dr. Daniel Kalla, a real-life ER doctor in BC, is also one of the most prolific writers. His latest thriller is called The Darkness in the Light, which has a noir flavor with killer twists. Dr. Dan joins us via Skype from British Columbia. Hi, Dan.
Hey, Peter. Always great to be back with you.
Always great to have you on the program, sir. This one, as I said, has a noir flavor to it. It's a little different, I guess, from some of the ones you've written in the past. But you write a lot of medical thrillers, so I'm curious to know, what draws you to a particular topic that you want to write about? Is it something that is in the news? Is it something as a doctor or a situation that scares you? What is it that draws you to something?
It's all those things, Peter. I'd say this is my 13th novel, and every one seems to have a different inspiration. You know, as you said, this is a departure for me. It's very much a psychological thriller. I wouldn't call it a, you know, one of the characters, one of the protagonists is a psychiatrist, but I would hesitate to call this a medical thriller. It's much more that Scandinavian noir style. And it all sprung because I had the idea for what I think is a killer twist that I have never seen. It's not that complex, but in all the mystery and thriller reading I've done in my years, I've never seen one executed quite this way because it's told in the first person. And so I built an entire story. I had an idea for a killer twist. And I wanted an incredibly remote, beautiful, exotic setting. And, you know, and I built the story from there. And I wanted to touch on, you know, some post-pandemic issues. And one of the big ones in medicine is virtual medicine. And so, you know, the psychiatrist is based, who's the hero, is based in Anchorage, Alaska, but he deals virtually with the second northernmost town in the world and the northernmost town in the Western Hemisphere in Utqiagvik, Alaska, which is the regional oil capital, but it's way up in the Arctic, and it's an incredible real town. And I was just blown away when I, you know, my daughter actually discovered the town. And but all this, I had this idea for a twist. I knew it had to be remote. I love Scandinavian noir style thrillers. I said, you know, and that's how this one was all instigated.
Well, in doing your research, did you venture to Alaska?
Oh, I would have. I've been to Alaska, but never remotely this far north. I would have loved to go, but I was writing it really during the, you know, the peak of the COVID crisis. I wouldn't be allowed to travel up there. And this town of Utqiagvik is fascinating because it's a town of 6,000. And as I said, it's a regional center for the oil industry, and it's about 50% indigenous, 50% sort of itinerant, a lot of oil workers, a lot of government workers and stuff. But the only way to get there is by air. There are no roads in and out. And you can get there for a couple months in the summer when the ice melts by ship. But, you know, there are 737s that fly there every day. And for me, it created this locked door mystery in this town itself. As, you know, there's a rash of suicides that evolve into maybe something more. And this psychiatrist who feels incredibly guilty because he loses one patient to what he assumes is suicide and another is missing. And he goes up there to try to to investigate himself to figure out what's going on. But it created this kind of locked door mystery in the setting that it is.
Well, you do realize that for press, you now have to go up there for a book signing.
I would love to. I feel like I know, you know, when I wrote the Shanghai trilogy that was historical, I studied Shanghai for months and months. And when I did go there, but when I got there, I felt like I knew the town because I'd read so much. And I have that same feeling about Utqiagvik. There's so many great online travelogues, and because it's such a unique place. And so, you know, I've studied maps, I've read everything I could about the town. So obviously, you know, I haven't been there, but I feel like I know it. And I bet if I did go up there, a lot of it would look familiar to me.
You touched a little bit on the plot of this book, but can you set up the story of what we can expect when we sure. crack open the pages of The Darkness in the Light?
Sure. So, you know, after an Alaskan psychiatrist loses a young patient to presumed suicide, he's determined not to lose another one when she goes missing. And he flies from Anchorage to Utqiagvik to investigate her disappearance. And he enlists the help of a social worker there who becomes pivotal to the story. And the two of them, for what begins for them as a missing persons inquiry and suspicion over maybe a pharmaceutical cover-up over a new antidepressant, quickly evolves into a terrifying journey of treachery and death. You know, and it sort of horrifies this isolated community and endangers many more lives. And as I said, nothing is what it seems from the outset. And as a little hint, this is not a medical thriller, but there is a lot of talk about depression. There are some triggering issues with depression and suicide. And in that part of the world, you know, suicide has one of the highest rates of suicide in Alaska, and especially northern Alaska, of anywhere in North America. And suicide has been on the rise during COVID anyway. So it's a vital issue. And the way I really made this, you know, tried to make it feel more personal and more realistic is the psychiatrist himself suffers from depression and had a previous suicide attempt. So he understands the issue both professionally and personally in a way that many people wouldn't.
And when you talk about something like mental health and depression, we're also discussing an issue that can be affected by light. And your story takes place in an area where at some times of the year, there isn't a lot of it.
Yeah, totally. It's in Utqiagvik, it's dark 2.5 months of the year. But this novel is set in the summer where it's light, where you get the polar summers, and the sun never sets for 2.5 months, which is equally as disrupting, you know, to circadian rhythms and to can be to mental health. And you know, that's why I was just so happy when we hit upon the title, because it says it all. You know, there's a lot of darkness going on in this town under the polar light.
You also alluded to the fact that a drug company is involved, is Big Pharma in this story. One of your last stories, one of your last novels, Lost Immunity, also had to deal with Big Pharma. By the way, that was a great book, although a little too close to home for me, as we've discussed in the past. But have you heard any pushback or had any pushback from the pharmaceutical company about some of the stuff you've written, both in this current book and in previous books?
Yeah, in this book, it's far more a peripheral issue than it was in the last book, where, as you said, it was fairly central. But even then, as you know, in Lost Immunity, it was more complicated than that. The drug companies get bashed all the time, and I think I treat them even-handedly. I think I've given them a lot of praise. You know, I think a lot of what happened with, you know, companies like Pfizer and Moderna and you know, even AstraZeneca and Johnson & Johnson during the pandemic, I think they did some really good stuff too. So I've never heard pushback from Big Pharma, and I have a very sort of mixed view of them. I think they're big, hungry corporations out for money, but I also think they often do, you know, good work and create things that are beneficial. Drugs are incredibly expensive to develop, billions of dollars. So, you know, there has to be profit as well. So, you know, I get it. But yeah, to answer your question, no pushback.
Well, getting back to the book, The Darkness in the Light, as we mentioned in the onset, it's a slightly different genre for what you're known for in the past. A chicken versus the egg kind of situation, which came first? Were you toying with the idea of doing this type of genre, or did you come up with the story and adapted it to this type of genre?
Yeah, good question. I think more the latter. I think because I wanted something, you know, a twist that's kind of a dark twist that I think is fair to the reader. I think, you know, there's little crumbs dropped along the way, but, you know, a lot of people seem very surprised when they get, there's a couple big twists in this book. One that happens in the middle, one that happens at the end. And I think as soon as I hit upon this idea and knew what had to happen, I realized that this kind of Scandinavian noir style, very much a noir story, would be the perfect vehicle to tell a story like this. And I've always loved, ever since I read The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, and the Joe Nesbitt books and stuff, I always really have enjoyed that. And there's such rife setting for thrillers. There's so much bleakness and barrenness and all the kind of things that really adds atmosphere. I really think the town and the setting itself becomes a major character in this novel, and I'm proud of that.
As I mentioned, as we've always mentioned, you are an ER doctor. You run an emergency department at a major hospital in Vancouver. And I'm just curious, and I've got to ask you before we let you go, with all that's been going on the last little while, I mean, just your last two books, The Last High, which deals with the opioid crisis, and Lost Immunity, which deals with a pandemic, you've been through a lot as a doctor in Vancouver. When do you come up for air, or have you been able to come up for air? Have things leveled off?
Yeah, I mean, to a degree. The emergencies are crazy busy as people are kind of returned to life. They're like catching up on 2 years of other health issues, you know, and people are going out tons and traveling tons again. So, COVID settled. It's never gone away. We still admit COVID patients pretty much every day. But to your point, you know, this is my air. You know, this has been my escape, has been my opportunity to write and tell stories. It's been incredible, because at times it was intense during the early stages of the pandemic. And so it was a great release for me. In fact, I wrote a lot of this book in the first year of the pandemic. And it was wonderful to have that outlet.
Excellent. Well, I'm looking forward to reading this one as well. The Darkness in the Light is the latest book by Dr. Dan Kala. Dan, thank you very much for being on the program with us once again.
Hey, you know, my pleasure. And I have to say, for your listeners to know, that Peter always does read my books. He never reads it before. I by policy, he won't read it before I appear, but afterwards, then we have great conversations off air. So I'm really looking forward to your book report.
And you'll get that report. That's Dr. Daniel Calla. His latest thriller is called The Darkness in the Light. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the page for this show, which is show number 0663, and you'll find links to Dan's website, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
There's still more guests, more news, and an idiot of the day coming your way on The Stuff File program. Stay tuned. The Stuff File program is a listener-supported, fan-funded radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Sign up and find out about our rewards program. Being a patron doesn't have to be a long-term commitment. There's absolutely no obligation. You could join today and end whenever you'd like, but the time we have your support would be so greatly appreciated. We'd also love to hear your thoughts about the show and even your ideas for rewards. Join us for the ride. Join us at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram. This is The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Pay very close attention. There could be a test leader.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk about reading to your children, plus Andrew Bezekas, the night sky guy, has some news from space. We also have an idiot of the day coming your way a little later on, and much more in Stuff File News here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Let's get back to it. In Washington State, a paraglider got caught about 30 feet up a tree at Poo Poo Point last week. The 60-year-old man was still stuck in the tree at around 5 p.m. A spokesperson for Eastside Fire and Rescue said a crew went to check on the man, who was not injured. A tree falling company was in the area at the time. They took over rescue efforts, according to the fire department. The workers already had the equipment needed to reach the man. You know, I'm pretty certain that as the paraglider was hurtling towards the trees, he mentioned Poo Poo Point several times. By the way, sidebar. In 2020, a cycling enthusiast by the name of Ruben Lopez spent 38 days cycling from Poo Poo Point in Washington to Pee Pee Creek in Ohio to raise money for the humanitarian crisis in Yemen. Lopez traveled exactly 69 miles each day of his journey. Not a mile more, not a mile less. Clearly, we see where his sense of humor lies. He raised more than $7,000 for the Yemen Relief and Reconstruction Foundation, again, cycling from Poo Poo Point to Pee Pee Creek. By the way, could you imagine what those two locations would say if they could talk to each other?
Call me by your name and I'll call you by mine.
Eric and Athena Tenzar bought their home abutting the Indian Pond Country Club golf course in Kingston, Massachusetts, for the beautiful views. However, they ended up suing the club over the 600-plus golf balls that have left dents and shattered windows in their home over 5 years. The couple said they've long since stopped repairing shattered windows, instead covering them with plastic. Said Athena, "When it hits, it sounds like a gunshot," added Eric. "We're always on edge." A Plymouth County Superior Court jury sympathized and awarded them $4.93 million. The club is now launching an appeal and has worked with the course's architect to find solutions for the errant projectiles.
"I'll guarantee you'll never be a member here."
"Member? Are you kidding? You think I'd join this crummy snobatorium? But this whole place sucks."
Far be it for me to ever side with a country club, but the Tenzars have been living in the home for over 5 years. However, the golf course has been there for 20 years. When you buy a house abutting a golf course, you pretty much have to expect golf balls from bad golfers coming your way. Quebec's Ministry of Health and Social Services made an epic mistake last week when a link intended to point to the latest COVID-19 figures in Quebec instead took confused clickers to a popular porn site. The link directed people to a Pornhub foot fetish video entitled Femdom Foot Worship. The faux pas wasn't recognized for 30 minutes last week. The department, which is also known as Santé Quebec, deleted the tweet and apologized to its more than 100,000 followers for the mistake. In the apology, they said, "Due to a situation beyond our control, a link with inappropriate content was posted on our Twitter account. We are looking for the causes. We are sorry for the inconvenience." I can understand how these mistakes can happen because I've been covering these types of mishaps for years. However, the one thing that never ceases to amaze me, and also amuse me, is the fact that going back to the beginning of my career, decades ago, whenever someone inadvertently posts the wrong website, or back in the day, printed the wrong toll-free number, it's always to a porn site. Nobody ever mixed up the number to a Bible college. Meanwhile, Darby Bodie, a Lakota school board member in Butler County, Ohio, was asked to resign on April 27th after she apparently mistakenly directed visitors on her Bodie for Lakota Facebook page to a pornographic website. Here we go again. On April 26th, she created a post about topics being taught in classrooms and included a link, but she spelled it wrong. Other board members of the school recognized that it was a mistake, but said she was negligent. Board President Linda O'Connor called the error absolutely unacceptable. In response, Bodie said, "This is a ruse, a political ruse. I did nothing wrong," and called the meeting a circus designed to shut down conservatives. Before the website incident, Bodie had been the subject of a petition signed by 1,500 people seeking her censure for continued disrespect and aggression toward Superintendent Matt Miller. She said she will never resign. Again, no one ever links to a Bible college. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Despite their hectic schedules and the distractions of social media and modern technology, families can dramatically improve their children's lives by setting aside time to read with them. Lori Lynn is an author and longtime educator. She's the author of the children's book, I'm a Pig. Lori joins us via Zoom from Iowa. Hi, Lori.
Hi, how are you today, Peter? Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being on the program with us. Reading, as the old commercial goes, reading is fundamental. It's always very important. But with, as I said, so many distractions out there, sometimes it's kind of hard to get the little ones to read. How is getting children to read different today than it was in previous generations?
Oh, what a great question. I think because it's not only the children that have a little bit less attention span, but adults are busy. And so what I advocate for is just relaxing into one book per night should make you feel like you've done enough. And the reason is because there's so much we can be doing, but when you can pull your child close and have that connectivity with them and that shared intimate conversation in a book, they're going to feel that security and safety and joy of reading. And that's what we need to instill in them, is that true joy and that warmth of a good book. And then the second point is to really find a quality book that you can give them lots of skills in a fun way without them really knowing it.
Now, how tactile of an experience should this be? And the reason why I bring that up is with, again, modern technology as it is, you know, we read a lot on Kindles and our iPads and other electronic devices. Is that okay as far as you're concerned, or do you actually like, for what I like to refer to as the dead tree version?
Well, if your listeners are doing some of those screens, it's fine, but there's a better way. I would say if you're going to put it on a scale when I train teachers. I'm like, if you have a scale of 1 through 5, it's a 3 out of 5. So you're not hurting children. But if that's all they get, it is hurting children. And a 5 out of 5 is really always going to be a dentry version of a book in hand where you turn the pages and you point at the pictures and they feel that. They don't, young children don't really understand the turning of the page on an online version of the book, a digital version. Now I have a digital version of my book because it's nice to have that too. But the tactile version, there's just no, there's no replacement for that and all it can bring for the understanding of the top of the book, the back of the book, the, you know, are you, do you have it upside down or any of that?
Okay. Well, you said it could be, it's okay, but it could be hurting children. How is it hurting children if you're only using a digital device?
Screen time. Children have enough screen time and the research is abundant on the disadvantage of the screen time for children. The tactile experience, as you say, involves so much more of their brain and their fine motor, whereas a screen version is just that, a screen version. And children are watching TV or seeing movies or playing on their iPads with games, and those are all good things, but it's all screen time. And screen time, too much screen time is not good for our brains, we know, and especially for children's brains. They need to be interacting with things to really develop those brain muscles and their finger muscles, and screens just can't do that for them, right? So,
have you ever noticed, I don't know if you're around a lot of really, really young children, say under 2, have you ever noticed a child looking at a book and trying to slide the finger across because they're already accustomed to the idea of how screens work?
Yes, I have seen that actually in the classroom. I do some substitute teaching because I was just begged to, because they're just so short, substitutes. And they're like, please, please come substitute a couple times a week. And so I go in and I'm doing some preschool work right now. And I have seen that happen a couple times. Yes.
That is frightening. I mentioned your book, I'm a Pig. So tell us what the book is about beyond the title. Because, you know, when I think I'm a pig, the first thing that comes to my mind, Charlotte's Web.
Yes, Wilbur.
Wilbur, yeah.
Yes, well, I'm a farm girl and I used to always love the little pigs, so it comes by naturally. I have a song that I wrote when my boys were little and they're in 30 now. I'm a grandma actually now and brand new. And I wrote this song when they were little and I always wanted to go out and get this recorded for children. And when my mom passed away in 2017, she took my hand and she says, it's time for you to go do those things for children. So with my mom's wish and a wing and a prayer, I went out and did the CD. And the most requested song is always, even in the classroom when I've sung it, is I'm a Pig. And so I've had librarians and teachers say, you need to make that into a book. So I did a Kickstarter during COVID because all of my gigs went away during COVID, as any musicians did. And so I did this Kickstarter and we got the book done.
Well, we should mention that you are, in addition to all the things I mentioned earlier, you are also a singer-songwriter. But now you say you're a grandmother. So this is a question that I think is important as a test, because you are someone who's really into being an educator. So you've got a 30-year time span, basically. How is it different reading to your grandchildren as opposed to when you were reading to your kids when they were young?
Well, the interesting thing is I found it's not as different as you think, because quality teaching, quality experiences with children don't change, Peter. That, you know, children don't change. Children's development doesn't change. It always is the same. Children walk before they crawl, before they walk. There's a few that don't, right? But they babble before they talk. They, you know, they get to know words before they ever put letters to and sounds together. So all of that doesn't change, but childhood has changed drastically. And so I think what's changed is our thought thinking. Well, we can't do it the same way because things are so different. Whereas I challenge people to say no, because child development always is the same. And we need to enjoy that journey that child development is, and not push them and not pressure them, and just pull up with a quality book. It's still quality, top quality way to have children learn. It's hearing our language and the rhythm of the language. And when you pair that with music, which is why I did I'm a Pig, is I learned throughout my career, because I was a music major before I was an elementary or early childhood major. And so it's just worked perfectly now in my later part of life that I've learned about the music and literacy connection. And we all know that music lights up our brain. We've seen videos of Alzheimer patients who can't remember things, but they hear a song or they sit at the piano and they can play it perfectly. That is because it activates different parts of our brain. So when a child knows a song like the ABCs, we do that for a reason. So they get to know the letters. When a child gets to know the song, I'm a Pig, and now it's in a book version, they already feel confident because they know the words that are going to be in there. And so I made the word pig red and in capital letters on every page. Anytime you see the word pig, it's red and in capital letters. Mm. So children, I tell them, you're going to be reading this book. And they're like, we don't know how to read. I'm like, I bet you will. And I show them that this is the word pig. And every time you see this word, it's pig. And guess what they're doing by the next page? That's pig. I'm like, you're reading. And so, right. And so it's that confidence. It's that joy that never changes.
No, so. Well, let me ask you this. When it comes to reading, and a lot of times when people read to children, it's a bedtime situation. Should you read to children before they go to bed or as they go to bed? Because I think there's a difference there.
Oh, I think it's part of when a family puts together their bedtime routine. I don't think it's so important where you do it as much as it's consistent each night. So if you decide reading a book right after dinner is a way that slows the heart rate down, and then you brush your teeth and maybe then you do songs, that's fine. Or if you decide to put the book in the rocking chair right before they go to bed, that's fine too, or read it when they're in the bed. The most important thing is to do it and not worry about if it's at the exact right time. Sometime between that bath time, toothbrush, then it's book, music, whatever you do, just make sure it's in there, because of all the things we can do to help children be successful in school, it's reading a book each night to them.
And you have a website, which is overallbuddies.com. What will people find when they go there?
Well, they can find the background of why I created Overall Buddies. You can find my book. I have a hardback and a special deluxe copy that I only made 500 of, and there's 200 of those left, and it has a shiny deluxe cover on it, and my CDs there, and my Obi doll, and the music videos, everything you want to see that Overall Buddies does is on overallbuddies.com.
Excellent. And judging by the symphony in the background, when are you doing the book I Am a Cat?
I am so sorry. I just meant to pick him up. I haven't been talking all day, and now when we talk, he's like a two-year-old, like, take me outside now. I'm so sorry. Sorry, listeners.
Well, no, that's okay.
I do have a song about a cat, of course. Are there kitties in this house? And, of course, you would answer, yes, there are.
And now I have to ask, do you read to your cat?
I don't, but my cat and dog put up with me and my guitar many, many, many hours.
Well, again, the website is overallbuddies.com. Lori, and the book again is I'm a Pig. Lori, I thank you very much for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Thank you so much, Peter, for your patience and having me on. I appreciate it.
Lori Lynn, author and longtime educator. Her website is overallbuddies.com, and she's the author of the children's book, I'm a Pig. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0663, and you'll find the link to her site, plus links to either amazon.com or amazon.ca, where you can order her book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
Got something for the mailbag? Send your email to mailbag@thestufffile.com. And remember, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H. That's mailbag@thestufffile.com.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Often I mention my book, Great Conversations, my interviews with two men on the moon and a galaxy of stars. I also often mention that I'd like you to become a patron of the Stuff File program via patreon.com. Well, this is my opportunity to combine both of those pleas to you. You've heard me say on many occasions about the myriad of celebrities I've had the chance to talk to that are contained in my book, which is published by Bear Manor Media. You've also heard me mention that some of the celebrities in my book, and many others, can be heard on our page at patreon.com. Well, if you've been on the fence about joining Patreon, let me try to pull you over to our side. By becoming a patron, you help to make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. And if you do become a regular patron, as a Patreon reward, I'll share with you an electronic version of my book for your e-reader. So join Patreon and claim your copy of Great Conversations, my interviews with two men on the moon and a galaxy of stars. Sign up today at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram.
From our studios in Montreal, Canada, and going out to the rest of the world, this is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Now, the Stuff File presents Andrew Fazekas, the Night Sky Guy. It's radio that's out of this world.
Andrew Fazekas, the Night Sky Guy, is a member of the Royal Astronomical Society of Canada and the author of National Geographic's Backyard Guide to the Night Sky. And Andrew, we've had another story of civilians in space, but this time around, they actually went into space and to the International Space Station.
That's right. I mean, SpaceX is really stepping up its game. It had these back-to-back missions this past month of April. It's just been so busy. Earlier this month, they had the Axiom 1 mission, which included three private astronauts. And it's run by a commercial crew that basically hired out SpaceX rocket and capsule, Dragon capsule, to take their paid customers to the space station. And then now, just last week, we had the latest mission, basically a NASA replacement crew for the International Space Station, with NASA's Kjell Lindgren, Bob Hines, and Jessica Watkins, Jessica's going to be the first long-term African-American who's going to be on this long-duration six-month mission on the International Space Station. And so the crew arrived late last week, Thursday night, and they're getting down to business of maintaining the space station. There's lots of experiments that they're going to be doing on board. And it's a really big compliment with these four astronauts. The space station is filled with seven that were already on the ISS. So it's a really jam-packed station. There's not much room left, but they won't have that problem for very long, because around on May 4th, there is the next scheduled departure of the next Dragon capsule, bringing three crew members back to Earth. So basically the population of the lab will decrease by a few numbers, and there'll be more leg room for everyone.
Well, May the 4th be with you. Have you seen the picture of all the crew member together on the space station? I think it's hysterical.
Yeah, I mean, it's just so jam-packed. It's crazy. And I don't know what I saw that, but what really caught my eye actually was very interesting. There was another one where there is this shot on the outside of the space station showing two flags, basically, that the old Soviet World War II flags that the Russians have put up. The whole question is, why is Russia bringing war symbols to the International Space Station? This was very interesting, and it's bringing in some controversy on the internet, specifically on Twitter. This was posted just, you know, a few days ago, and it's garnering a lot of replies and commentary on what exactly is going on. Why are the Russians politicizing the International Space Station when it's meant to avoid all politics?
Ooh, controversy on Twitter. There's something new. Wow. Anyway, the picture I was talking about was with all 11 of them inside the space station, including, I think, four or five of them were upside down. Have you seen that picture?
Yeah, brilliant of the astronauts showing off, of course, with microgravity. That's a lot of fun. And that's, you know, I'm wondering, actually, Peter, you know, with all these people, you're not hearing too much about people getting spacesick lately. And that's always traditionally been a big problem with, you know, long duration spaceflight missions, and that astronauts are struggling with the microgravity and the inner ear balance issues. It's interesting to see, definitely. I mean, when you have a 6-month mission, you really want to make sure maybe you have some Dramamine, I guess, with you.
Meanwhile, in other news, I mean, we keep talking about it, but it keeps sending us amazing pictures. There are new sharp pictures from the James Webb Space Telescope as it completes alignment.
Yeah, that's right. What they're doing basically at this point is really just sharpening ever more, making those images, you know, really crisp, very focused images. And this new release just this last week by NASA's James Webb Space Telescope team shows that a lot of their instruments, because there's multiple instruments on board that are devoted to different resolutions, you can see on all of them, you know, like everything from the guidance telescopes that really keep the telescope oriented properly to the real ones that are going to produce the wow images. There are sharp, sharp, sharp. And it's really impressive what they're doing. So they're really starting basically a new phase of preparation over the next few months, where all of these instruments and the mirrors are being super aligned properly. And this is what's going to allow us in probably by, you know, mid-June, end of June, we're expecting that if everything continues to go as it has, we'll be able to get our first real science images and get wowed about it. And I expect that there's going to be a release of some impressive stuff by the end of June.
Well, even though it's not set up yet so that it's starting its so-called mission and sending great scientific pictures, even in the ones that have been sent already, has anything been learned from those rudimentary pictures?
It's looking, you have to remember, the telescope is designed to look in the near, in the infrared part of the spectrum. So it's the far red part of the spectrum of light that the human eye can't really see. And why that's so important in the telescope mission is that this allows us to peer through clouds of gas and dust that may be between us and the object that we want to study. And so it just kind of pulls back the curtain of gas and dust. That's what our vision in the infrared allows us to do. And that's why this telescope, James Webb, is actually more powerful than the Hubble Space Telescope. And these very first images that they're using to calibrate the telescope has shown us already that the telescope has an exquisite ability to do just that, to peel back those layers of curtains of gas and dust that particularly are around in the earlier part of the universe. And some of these calibration images of bright stars that are within the Milky Way galaxy have revealed a multitude of galaxies in the background of the image. So in the foreground, you have these bright stars that they're using to test everything. But even in these test images, you're seeing galaxies that we don't even have names for. We've never seen them before because we haven't had powerful enough telescopes to reveal them. They're just, their light is just too feeble. So it's really impressive already, these test images. It's tantalizing. And we're just chomping at the bits to really, really put it to the test.
So it's going to be finding the Where's Waldo of galaxies for us in the future, I guess.
Pretty much, yeah. There's just more and more. We think that there's about 100 billion galaxies was estimated in the observable universe. And we always say amongst astronomers that it's the observable universe. But really, there might be, you know, many more, over a trillion galaxies perhaps, that are just waiting to be discovered.
Meanwhile, and finally, there was an asteroid that just passed by. And apparently this was really close. It was within our atmosphere.
That's right. This happened just late last week on Thursday. It was the size of the Empire State Building. It has a very unromantic name of 2008 AG33. So it had a sort of like a diameter somewhere between 350 to 800 meters across. And it just barreled through, you know, into Earth's orbit at about 37,000 kilometers per hour. Now, luckily, it skipped past our planet. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't that close. At the closest, it was about 3 million kilometers away from us. And that's roughly about 8 times the distance between the Earth and the Moon. So no problems. This was we had a really good ringside seat. I mean, that sounds like a lot when you're saying over 3 million kilometers, but you know, when you're talking about astronomical distances, that is really just a hair's breadth away from Earth. You know, this is something very interesting to astronomers that do study what we call potentially hazardous asteroids. These are any kind of rocks in space that come within about under 200 million kilometers away from Earth. And these are the ones that when we project out their pathways over, as they circle the sun over decades and centuries, we can plot out that they intersect their orbits, their pathways eventually intersect with Earth's orbit. And so that's why these near-Earth objects or potentially hazardous asteroids are followed so intently. Because when it comes, like this particular one came so close to us, you know, it was first discovered in 2008 and it's been followed ever since then. Whenever it makes this close approach to the Earth-Moon system, both Earth and the Moon's gravity pull tweaks its orbit just a little bit so that the next flyby is going to be basically affected the pathway from this earlier intersection with Earth and the Moon. So, you know, looking out, there's no chance of it colliding from what we can see, but every time it does come close to us, we can actually modify our projections forward and say, well, is it, you know, what's the hazard, you know, level from this?
And very quickly, because we're just out of time, is there anything that anyone could have seen it with? As far as equipment, could you see it with a telescope as it goes by?
Not at that distance, really. It's and it really depends on what the asteroid is made of. If it's very reflective material, very dark, okay, charcoal-like material, that really influences how it's seen. But some of them, if they do get close, like the ones that go about 30,000 kilometers away from us, where that's the same height as where geosynchronous satellites go, those even backyard astronomers can follow them. They're bright enough because they're so close to us. And that's happened quite a few times.
Okay. All I want to say is Bennu's coming.
Yeah, you and the Bennu.
Anyway, sir.
Bennu will be fine. We'll be all right.
Okay. Andrew, thank you very much for being on the program with us once again.
As always, my pleasure. And I wish everyone clear skies.
Andrew Fizakis, the Night Sky Guy, and the author of National Geographic's Backyard Guide to the Night Sky. You can check out his website at thenightskyguy.com, and you can go to my website at thestufffile.com to the page for this show, which is show number 0663, and you'll find links to Andrew's site, plus links to either amazon.com or amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. We have a few more Stuff File news stories to share with you before we get to the idiot of the day, so let's get to it right now. Guests at a February wedding reception in Florida reported feeling high and ill, having crazy thoughts, and having no control over their mind and body after consuming pasta, salad, and an olive oil and herb dip. This is not like the lovey-dovey, touchy-feely wedding story we told you earlier in the show. And it's no wonder the bride, 42-year-old Dania Svoboda, and 31-year-old caterer Jocelyn Bryant, were charged on April 18th with allegedly adding marijuana to the food served to wedding guests, several of whom ended up at the hospital. One victim told the best man that he felt like he had been drugged, but the best man was incoherent himself. The groom's 69-year-old aunt reported that she became paranoid and loud and unruly in the ER. One catering staffer thought the guests were aware that THC was in the food. 38-year-old Miranda Cady, a friend of the bride, or perhaps former friend of the bride, said Svoboda behaved as if guests should be happy about the addition to the food. Katie was terrified and sent herself a text so if she died, someone would know what happened. Svoboda and Bryant are scheduled to be arraigned in June. You know, right about now, I'm assuming that the thank you cards that the bride sends out for all her wedding gifts is going to be somewhat awkward. And when a load of weird items were delivered to a Los Angeles area charity in February, a worker there thought the donor must have been rich or famous or whatever. But early last month, one item drew the attention of the Los Angeles Police Department. A large stuffed reindeer that had a hole on its underside. A staff member at the charity was inspecting the hole to see if it could be fixed when three bags of white powder fell out. Officers said the substance resembled cocaine, but they took Blitzen away for further investigation. Wow. Apparently, it's not only Rudolph who wasn't allowed in any reindeer games. And boys and girls, it's the moment you've all been waiting for. It's time now for the Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for the Strange Things Adults Do. This stuff all presents the Idiot of the Day.
In the UK, a man has been arrested after reportedly trying to sell stolen goods to the public while they were gathered at a crime scene in Grimsby. The man, seen by witnesses with a large variety of meat, was spotted trying to sell items in Grimsby. At the time, Humberside police were at the scene of a major investigation where a man was arrested following a 12-hour rooftop standoff. Following the carnage caused by tiles and bricks being thrown down onto the street, police sealed off the area and a cordon was put in place until the situation was brought under control. While police were at the scene, a man reportedly approached members of the public trying to sell what is believed to have been stolen meat. After leaving the area, he later returned to the scene and allegedly continued to try to sell the goods. However, he was soon arrested.
We have the meat.
Yeah, but it's stolen. Now why, oh why, would you try to sell stolen meat in an area where there is a police standoff and cops are everywhere? One reason, and one reason only, you're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program number 0663. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com. And once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links in all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0663. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as PA Holder. And don't forget to check us out on patreon.com, where you can become a patron of the program. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including KDXRadio.com, TrueTalkRadio.com, streaming on Audible, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Amazon Music, Spotify, Stitcher, and iHeartRadio, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, WLSLLPFM in Dade City, Florida, CKUWFM in Winnipeg, CFMU in Hamilton, CKLU in Sudbury, and local 107.3 FM in St. John. That's it. Bye-bye.
You've been getting jiggy with Peter Anthony Holder and the Stuff File program, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. He's a bad mamma jamma, and after he spends some chill time in his crib, he'll be back to get down with his bad self. Word up.